right after the international news.
Today is Thursday, January 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. and NATO reject key Russian security demands for easing tensions over Ukraine.
If Russia walks away, however, it will be quite apparent they were never serious about pursuing diplomacy at all. That is why collectively we are preparing for every eventuality.
President Joe Biden pushes legislation to prevent states from imposing laws that limit access to the vote.
Will we choose democracy over autocracy, light over shadows, justice over injustice? I know where I stand. I will not yield. I will not flinch. I will defend the right to vote.
And Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab claims responsibility for a bombing Wednesday that killed at least 9 people. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The U.S. and NATO have rejected key Russian security demands for easing tensions over Ukraine, but they left open the possibility of future talks with Moscow to discuss other things like arms control, missile deployments, and ways to prevent military incidents. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman warned Russia that stark choices over Ukraine were de-escalation and diplomacy, or confrontation and consequences. Russia is demanding security assurances from the NATO alliance, including a halt to eastern expansion and withdrawal of forces from Central and Eastern European nations that joined it after the Cold War. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg received Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko at the talks Wednesday. The talks are the highest profile attempt at NATO to turn a potential military conflict over Ukraine into a political and diplomatic process. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman.
If Russia walks away, however, it will be quite apparent they were never serious about pursuing diplomacy at all. That is why collectively we are preparing for every eventuality. We have made it clear, and we told the Russians directly again today, that if Russia further invades Ukraine, there will be significant costs and consequences well beyond what they faced in 2014. We remain ready to continue to engage with Russia. The heavy pace of bilateral and multilateral engagements this week demonstrates that the United States and our allies and partners are not dragging our feet. It is Russia that has to make a stark choice: de-escalation and diplomacy, or confrontation and consequences. We expect, and had expected, that the Russian delegations at the SSD here at the NATO-Russia Council and tomorrow at the OSCE will have to report back to President Putin, who we all hope will choose peace and security. They are a powerful country. The fact that they feel threatened by Ukraine, a smaller and still developing democracy, is hard to understand, quite frankly. Why they need 100,000 troops on the border, which they say are not for invasion but are for exercising, when live fire exercises are reported this morning. What is this about? Is this about invasion? Is this about intimidation? Is this about trying to be subversive? I don't know, but it is not conducive to getting to diplomatic solutions. So Russia has a choice to make. There was no commitment to de-escalate, nor was there a statement that there would not be. I think one of the things that Russia has done, which it probably did not expect, it has brought all of Europe, NATO and non-NATO allies alike, together to share the same set of principles, the same ambition, the same hopes, and the same commitment to diplomacy.
That's U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko says he cannot recall such a frank and sharp discussion with NATO as Wednesday's talks in Brussels, and that Moscow cannot concede more grounds to the U.S.-led alliance in certain areas. He says Russia told NATO that the situation cannot remain as it is currently, that Moscow wants to find a way out, and that Russia does not take NATO's statements of its peaceful purposes seriously. He says various NATO positions are unacceptable for Moscow. President Joe Biden is pushing legislation to prevent states from imposing laws that limit access to the vote, arguing that voting rights are a bedrock of American value and need to be better protected. His Republican opponents want states to support more rigorous voter identification and ballot security measure to prevent voter fraud. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
U.S. President Joe Biden is throwing his weight behind politically divisive legislation that would allow more federal oversight over elections. saying the stakes are high in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election. Speaking at Atlanta on Tuesday, he painted the two bills in stark terms.
Will we choose democracy over autocracy, light over shadows, justice over injustice? I know where I stand. I will not yield. I will not flinch. I will defend the right to vote, our democracy against all enemies, foreign and, yes, domestic. And the question is, where will the institution of the United States Senate stand?
In the past year, at least 19 states have passed laws restricting access to voting, according to New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. Biden wants to amend the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act, arguing that the federal government should rein in states that try to discourage eligible voters by making voting inconvenient, difficult, or confusing. Biden made his argument in Georgia, one of the handful of states where former President Donald Trump claims voter fraud led to his loss in the 2020 presidential election. There's no evidence to back that claim. This debate is urgent, he said, after Trump's election fraud claims triggered a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, as Trump supporters tried to force legislators to stop certifying Biden's win. But, says John Fortier of the American Enterprise Institute, this will be an uphill battle.
It's still a pretty broad-based set of changes that would apply everywhere nationally, that would overrule the states. And there's lots of enthusiasm on the Democratic side, partly because they believe in these issues generally, but partly also with January 6th and other things that are motivating them to think that these changes are what's needed. That being said, there is no support on the Republican side.
Members of Trump's party largely oppose the legislation. They argue that Republicans aren't seeking to block anyone's access to the polls, but rather to protect against voter fraud. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
It appears as if the majority leader is hell-bent to try to break the Senate. His argument is that somehow state legislatures across the country are busily at work trying to make it more difficult for people to vote. Of course, that's not happening anywhere in America.
Voting rights activists say they see clear evidence of discrimination in these new voting laws. Some key activists skipped Biden's speech, saying they wanted action from the president, not words. Rebecca Carruthers is vice president of the Fair Election Center.
What we're seeing within the United States is that we're being told that not everyone has the same right to vote, especially young people, especially those who are disabled, especially communities of color, Black people, Latinos, Latinx people, Asian, Native American, Indigenous people. They're being told that your right to vote doesn't matter as much, as well as those who have immigrated to our country and have become naturalized citizens.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has pledged to bring the legislation to the floor for a vote before next week. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
A U.S. Capitol Police officer filed suit against former President Donald Trump on the one-year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. Brianna Kirkland accuses Trump of causing emotional and physical pain during the attack. It is the latest in a string of suits filed against Trump. Kirkland says Trump played, quote, a central role in inciting the insurrection, unquote. The lawsuits accuse Trump of violating the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, which prohibits mob violence aimed at obstructing the operations of the federal government and its officers. The title refers to an infamous white supremacy movement that arose after the U.S. Civil War in the 1800s. VOA's Carol Van Dam asked criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor Jack Rice what he makes of the lawsuits.
There are people on both sides of this aisle on that law and whether or not they're stretching this law beyond its breaking point. But I do appreciate the thought, because there is a maxim, I think, in the United States that everybody should be held to account. Nobody is above the law, and that we are all responsible for the acts that we commit. And if we look at what it was that the former president did on January 6th of 2020, and what he did and what supporters did at his request, the idea that he would be responsible is something that actually has a very long standing acceptance in the criminal world, where you say you can be conspiratorially responsible for the acts of others if you were working in concert. And this idea of working in concert is exactly what that law is about. And so to stretch it out, it may be a bit further than it was, certainly further than it was intended. But at the same time, the notion of what's underneath it, I think, does have some traction.
How do you see these kinds of cases going compared to what the congressional panel is doing? I mean, do you think that this is actually going to be on a track that moves faster, perhaps?
Well, it might. I mean, I think the real concern with what Congress is doing right now on these hearings is that it's very likely we're going to see a flip in the House. And if there's a flip in the House coming up in a year, what you're going to see is every single one of those hearings simply disappear because the Republicans will be in control. And they have been obstructing every single investigation since the beginning of this. They've tried to rebrand this as something else to characterize it as something else. Since they have done that, there's no reason to assume they wouldn't do it again.
You heard, I'm sure as everybody else did, President Biden's fiery speech in Statuary Hall, the place where it was overrun by the rioters on January 6th, a year ago. Do you think that with the statements that he made and the remarks that he made about the former president, that he has changed any minds in the Republican Party?
No. No. I think that what we have seen from Republicans was an acknowledgement of what this was and then a very quick pivot. It seems to me now what we're finding is that there is almost a requirement in order to be in a position of power, heck, maybe even any position within the Republican Party, you need to be pushing the big lie argument. And the idea that you would see anybody change at this point seems unlikely. The very small number of Republicans who have come out acknowledging what happened on those days and what the evidence objectively seems to be pointing towards have been diminishing. And they have been attacked from all sides. They're getting challenged in primaries. And my expectation is that there will be fewer and fewer of those during the next election.
That's Jack Rice, a criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor and former CIA officer, speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. A prototype pistol that can read fingerprints and requires a passcode before firing may herald a new era of, quote, smart guns, unquote, developed in an effort to improve gun safety in the U.S. This report is produced by Zachary Goldman of Reuters.
So you check on the...
It's a frosty January day at this firing range in Boise, Idaho, where the rangemaster checks and readies to fire a new prototype of what might be the handgun of the future. Developed by Lodestar Works, this 9mm pistol is a prototype smart gun, equipped with fingerprint reader, passcode, and a way to lock and unlock it from a mobile phone.
Right now we're testing two different positions for that biometric from an ergonomic standpoint. First being right here, where you'd either touch it with your thumb or your index finger. The opposite side with your index finger more when you're in a shooting position.
Rob Regent is a mechanical engineer with SGW Design Works, which is building the Lodestar prototype.
The second authentication method is a pin pad right here. And what those are just more or less tactile push buttons. There's three of them. You know, you can do 4 to 6 digits. It acts much like an electronic door lock would. The third method is the BLE or the Bluetooth low energy. And basically we have a mobile application that would communicate wirelessly to the gun. And you can lock or unlock from any of those methods altogether.
Personalized smart guns, which can only be fired by verified users, may finally be available to U.S. consumers after 2 decades of questions about reliability and concerns they will usher in a new wave of government regulation.
And it just went, and you're hot now.
Lodestar co-founder Gareth Glaser told Reuters the inspiration for the company came after hearing one too many stories about children shot while playing with an unattended gun.
I'd seen the abject failure of every policy to try to make to do something about gun safety, lobbying and regulations and lawsuits and, and it all goes nowhere. Not one life is saved. In fact, the statistics just keep going up.
Advocates say smart guns could also reduce suicides. A lost or stolen gun would be useless, and police officers would not have to fear that their own service weapons might be taken and used against them. But not everyone believes smart guns are the solution.
If I had a nickel for every time in my career I heard somebody say, you're about to bring a
so-called smart gun on the market, I'd probably be retired now.
Lawrence Keene is with the National Shooting Sports Federation, a firearm trade group.
As we understand the concept, it's to allow someone to have a loaded firearm, relying upon the technology to make it safe and that it can't be used by somebody. If you have one of these firearms and you're relying upon technology, you know, it's one of the other principles. Never rely upon technology. Always treat every firearm as if it's loaded until you're sure that it's not.
The NSSF says it does not oppose smart guns as long as the government doesn't mandate their sale. The Lodestar gun would sell for $895. Similar firearms are being readied for market by other developers.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters. China's expanding sphere of influence and economic reach in Europe is met with a mixture of praise and complaints in the Greek port of Piraeus. Athens reporter Lauren Loughlin has the details.
Since the Chinese company Costco took over management of Piraeus, Greece's biggest port, the tonnage handled by the port's container terminal has quintupled and jobs are being created. But some workers say they are not seeing the benefits. Greek shipowner Nicolas Vernikos is one of the happy ones. He says what's happening here is good for business.
The investment that was made by the Chinese company Costco in the managing company of the Piraeus port is very positive for Greece.
But Konstantinos Spiropoulos, vice chairman of a union at the port, says most of the new investment has gone into the container sector, leaving the ship repair sector where he works behind. Among his frustrations in his sector, 200 men have to share a single toilet.
So all the guys working in the ship as a crew and as repairmen, they all have to deal with this toilet and clean their hands in the COVID years.
Chinese shipping company Costco now owns 67% of the port. In 2016, the Chinese ambassador to Greece said Piraeus was a key link of the Belt and Road Initiative. He also spoke of Greece's potential to become a transportation hub in this part of the Mediterranean. Under a contract signed that year, Costco committed to purchasing a 51% stake in the port immediately and another 16% after 5 years. It also pledged to invest 294 million euros in the port. But the pledge was not fulfilled within the five-year period, says Vasilis Kanakakis, president of a shipyard union.
Instead of imposing the penalty, we granted them the additional 16% and an extension of 5 years for implementation. This is catastrophic because if this place stays like this for 10 more years, none of us will be here.
Derek Scissors, American Enterprise Institute China economy expert.
That's one of the issues with becoming dependent on China. I think China has helped Greece with the improvement of Piraeus. But if you become unhappy with the Chinese presence for whatever reason, you're now stuck because who else is going to come in and take over that port the way that, you know, and operate it the way the Chinese have? Nobody.
Costco did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Vernikos, who is also president of the International Chamber of Commerce, says the Chinese presence benefits his country, especially considering Greece's recent emergence from a decade-long financial crisis. Again, Greek shipowner Nicolas Vernikos.
Piraeus is developing, or in fact is the fastest growing port of the world. More and more cargo ships visit Piraeus.
The Piraeus Port Authority chairman, Yu Zengang, says thousands of jobs will be created to support the port and the community around it. But Kanakakis questions the quality of the jobs at the port.
Temporary and low-wage positions have been created.
While some port workers worry about wages and working conditions, others at the port are banking on the business that its Chinese owners will bring. Laurent Laughlin for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
Political opponents of Lebanese President Michel Aoun are resisting his call for a national dialogue conference on the worsening economic crisis and other issues, sensing he may try to use it for his and Hezbollah's political gain. Meanwhile, the nation's currency has plummeted further by more than 15% of its value since the start of the year, leading to more misery for ordinary Lebanese. For VOA, Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
Michel Aoun, Lebanon's Christian president who provides political cover for the Iran-backed Shiite Hezbollah militia and political power broker, says a national defense strategy could be part of the talks. Lebanon observer Michael Young says calling for a national defense strategy has particular resonance for Hezbollah. Writing in Dubai's The National newspaper, Young says this is another term for finding a formula to integrate the party's weapons arsenal into the state. Many Lebanese have long called for Hezbollah, which is the only militia to have kept its arms from Lebanon's 1975 to 1990 civil war, to decommission its weapons. But Aoun's opponents suspect he may be hedging for talks as a means to corner Hezbollah into bolstering his son-in-law, Gibran Basile's, chances to succeed him in the presidency when his term ends later this year. So far, former Sunni Muslim Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, Druze leader Walid Jumblatt, and Aoun's Christian rival Samir Jaja have rejected his invitation for talks. Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA he sees Aoun and Basile jockeying for influence ahead of elections for parliament in May and those for the presidency later in the year.
This political theater, much of it is contrived and calculated with very clear aims in mind. Basile is sinking fast in terms of any popularity among the Christians, and for him to even remotely hope to succeed in the upcoming May elections, let alone be Hezbollah's candidate for the presidency next November, he's going to really have to perform a Houdini-like contortion. And what we're seeing right now is a calculated move to try and polish his image before any remaining gullible Christians.
Many Lebanese are also frustrated by the failure of the country's cabinet to meet for 3 months, hamstrung by Hezbollah and its Shiite ally, the Amal political party, over a dispute they have with the investigating judge on the deadly 2020 Beirut port explosion. Such a meeting is necessary to revive talks with the International Monetary Fund in the hopes of a financial bailout to help Lebanon's tanking economy. On Tuesday, the national currency dramatically fell to a new low of more than 33,000 pounds to the dollar, compared to 27,400 at the end of 2021, according to the Reuters news agency. Just 2 years ago, however, the Lebanese pound traded 1,500 to the dollar. Lebanese unions and the transport sector are calling Thursday for a day of rage or protest and workers' strikes. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
News, prices paid by U.S. consumers jumped 7% in December from a year earlier, the highest inflation rate since 1982, and the latest evidence that rising costs for food, gas, rent, and other necessities are heightening the financial pressure on America's households. Inflation has spiked during the recovery from the pandemic recession, as Americans have ramped up spending on goods such as cars, furniture, and appliances. Those increased purchases have clogged ports and warehouses, an exacerbated supply shortage of semiconductors and other parts. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a bombing Wednesday near the capital's international airport that killed at least 9 people. Mohamed Kahiye spoke to authorities and witnesses in this report from Mogadishu.
Somalia's police force spokesman Al-Fattah Hassan Ali confirmed the casualties were a result of a suicide attacker who detonated a car bomb. He says, before they used it to target security agencies and government officials, but that is over today, and the target is Somali civilians. Mogadishu Deputy Mayor Ali Yare Ali said he survived the Wednesday attack and that the security agencies have launched an investigation. He says the security agencies will investigate the target of the attack and will share the outcome when we have finalized the inquiry. We ask the security agencies to beef up the security. He added that the enemy cannot intimidate us. Terrorist group Al-Shabaab claimed the responsibility for the attack, which it said targeted a convoy carrying foreigners. The claim could not be independently verified. Deadly blast comes just days after Somali leaders agreed to hold long-delayed elections in February after a dispute that widened a rift between the president and the prime minister. Analysts have been warning that Al-Shabaab will take advantage of the political tensions and any perceived power vacuum to launch attacks. The U.S. Embassy in Somalia condemned the Wednesday terrorist attack. Mohamed Kaye, For VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The aid group, the International Rescue Committee, says severe drought is affecting more than 3 million people in Somaliland and southeast Ethiopia. The IRC says the two Horn of Africa nations are among 20 countries in the world most at risk for a worsening humanitarian crisis this year. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
Ethiopia and Somalia are among 20 countries on the International Rescue Committee's emergency watch list for 2022. Richard Crothers is the IRC country director for Somalia. He says the humanitarian situation in the two countries is not good.
The Horn of Africa has been on the verge of crisis for some time. There have been several consecutive failed rainy seasons, and we've come to a situation right now where we're having a significant amount of food insecurity, human displacement.
The IRC says the lack of rainfall has led to the driest conditions in 40 years in parts of Somalia and Ethiopia. At least 3 million people have been affected by drought, and more than 170,000 have fled their homes in search of water, pasture and humanitarian assistance. 47-year-old Noor Ahmed fled his hometown with his 60 cattle. He says he's transported his cattle from Birgod to Horai's town. In Horai's district, the local administration and the people welcomed us. I'm still here. He says there are some challenges. The cattle are finding it difficult to adapt to the area, and we need some medicine. We use water from the borehole, but we don't have enough storage. He says if we can get a place to store the water, that could help us a lot. Crothers says women and children are the most affected by the drought.
Particularly the children under five are the most hit. It's destroying livelihoods. Crops, herds of cattle that were once large have been diminished. So it's a rather desperate situation. I think, as usual, it's particularly the women and children that are getting hit the hardest.
Abdiaziz Bashir is a businessman based in the port city of Kismayo, who deals with buying and selling of livestock. He lost 99 animals to the drought. He says, I had 118 livestock, only 19 survived. I lost the rest of the drought. I'm yet to recover from that loss, Bashir says. He adds, the only good thing is that I no longer spend money on food to feed the remaining animals. They can get water and pasture for now. Aid agencies in Ethiopia and Somalia says food prices have gone up and some people cannot afford basic food to feed their families. The IRC says it has launched a response in Ethiopia's Somali region and says more money is needed to scale up humanitarian assistance in other areas. The aid agencies call for more funding to support cash assistance, food, water and sanitation facilities to combat health challenges. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. What's behind Russia's unprovoked military buildup along Ukraine's borders? Is Russian President Vladimir Putin worried that Ukraine's affinity with the West and desire to adhere to the rule of law threaten his autocratic rule? We'll ask our guest, Bill Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, now vice president at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. U.S. President Joe Biden is making a forceful pitch for passage of voting rights legislation that he and many others see as crucial to the integrity of U.S. democracy. This is Republican-controlled legislatures are passing laws restricting access to the ballot. We will discuss this and many more obstacles on the U.S. Politics edition of Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Okwu in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
This
voice of America. Washington, D.C.